Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
What is very real is that people are fleeing this advance of the RSF. Their stories are unfortunately all the same. Rape, murder, forced recruitment of children, separation of families, and sheer robbery.
In Sudan, fighting continues after the UAE-backed RSF attacked a kindergarten, killing over 40 children. We'll get an update. Then torture and enforced disappearances in the Sunshine State, human rights violations at Alligator Alcatraz and Chrome in Florida.
What we found in both facilities were serious human rights violations, cruel conditions, and real abuses.
We'll talk to the mother of the nephew of White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt, who was released from an ICE jail Tuesday. We'll also talk about the 19-year-old Babson College freshman arrested at a Boston airport and deported as she flew to surprise her family in Texas for Thanksgiving. Then, sick and tired, she wasn't. We'll look at the rebellious life of Rosa Parks on this 70th anniversary of the Montgomery bus boycott.
I felt that I was not being treated right, then that I had a right to retain the seat that I had taken as a passenger on the bus. The time had just come when I had been pushed as far as I could stand to be pushed, I suppose. They placed me under arrest.
All that and more. Coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hamas is calling for greater international pressure on Israel before agreeing to the next phase of the U.S. brokered Gaza ceasefire. Hamas says Israel must open key border crossings, halt military strikes and home demolitions, and allow for more humanitarian aid into the besieged territory. Palestinian health officials report since the ceasefire took effect October 10th, Israel's killed at least 376 Palestinians. Meanwhile, Israel continues to bar international journalists from independently entering Gaza after the country's top court on Tuesday delayed a legal challenge seeking to overturn the media restrictions. Meanwhile, UNICEF says 9,300 children in Gaza were treated for severe acute malnutrition in October when the first phase of the ceasefire deal came into effect. This is UNICEF spokesperson Tess Ingram.
Mothers cannot afford to buy their children the nutritious food that's available in the markets. Fruits and vegetables, which are now here, remain very expensive. And animal products like dairy and meat, even more so. For example, a UNICEF market survey done in November found that meat still on average costs about US $20 a kilo. So most families can't access this, and that's why we're still seeing high rates of malnutrition.
In news from Yemen, forces backed by the United Arab Emirates have claimed control of the oil-rich southern half of Yemen, including the city of Aden. Analysts say the military advance could result in renewed fighting between UAE and Saudi-backed groups, as well as southern Yemen possibly becoming an independent country again. President Trump's publicly pressing Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to accept a peace deal, saying Ukraine is, quote, losing the war with Russia. In an interview with Politico, Trump also said it was time for Ukraine to hold elections. Zelensky responded by saying Ukraine could soon be ready for long-delayed elections if the U.S. ensures security. In Oslo, Norway, the 2025 Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to the right-wing Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, but she did not attend the ceremony. Her daughter accepted the prize on her behalf. Ahead of the ceremony, Machado said she was heading to Oslo but would not arrive in time for the event. She's been in hiding for the past year. On Tuesday night, hundreds of protesters marched in Oslo to condemn the selection of Machado, who supported Trump's threats against against the Venezuelan government. In October, she dedicated the Peace Prize to President Trump. In related news, two U.S. F-18 fighter jets entered Venezuelan airspace for 40 minutes Tuesday as the U.S. escalates its threats against the Maduro government. The jets circled the Gulf of Venezuela near the city of Maracaibo. Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union and the Center for Constitutional Rights have sued the Trump administration, seeking the release of the secret legal memo that's been used to justify the U.S. campaign targeting alleged drug boats in the Caribbean and the Pacific. The U.S. has struck at least 22 boats, killing 87 civilians since September. On Tuesday, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth gave a classified briefing to members of Congress, but he refused to commit to show lawmakers a full, unedited video of a September 2nd strike on two shipwrecked men who'd survived an earlier U.S. strike that killed nine about 40 minutes before. Honduran President Xiomara Castro has accused President Trump of interfering with Honduras's recent election and said a, quote, electoral coup is occurring. Honduran election officials are still processing ballots from the November 30th election after numerous delays. The Trump-backed candidate, Nasri Esfura, has a narrow lead over Salvador Nasrallah, who's also alleged fraud. President Xiomara Castro spoke Tuesday.
In this election, the people were subjected to coercion, blackmail, extortion, tricks, fraud, and the manipulation of the preliminary results transmission system. These threats are a direct attack on the popular will.
At a rally in Pennsylvania Tuesday, President Trump again attacked Democratic Congressmember Ilhan Omar in a racist, expletive-filled rant while calling for more immigration from Northern European nations.
We had a meeting, and I say, why is it we only take people from whole countries, right? Why can't we have some people from Norway, Sweden, just a few? Let us have a few. From Denmark, do you mind sending us a few people? Send us some nice people. Ilhan Omar, whatever the hell her name is, with the little turban. I love her. She comes in, does nothing but bitch.
During the speech, President Trump also called concerns over affordability a hoax. In response, Democratic Congressmember Ilhan Omar posted on social media, quote, Trump's obsession with me is beyond weird. He needs serious help. Since he has no economic policies to tout, he's resorting to regurgitating bigoted lies instead. He continues to be a national embarrassment. Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis signed an executive order Monday declaring the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, a foreign terrorist organization. The move follows a similar declaration issued last month by Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott. Like in Texas, the Florida executive order also designates the Muslim Brotherhood a foreign terrorist organization. This is Imran Ghani, director of CARE's Houston chapter.
So these two governors are fomenting anti-Muslim hate, bigotry, and these accusations are totally conspiracy-based and done to stoke fear of Muslims. From a human perspective, it continues to make Muslims, who are part of the cultural fabric of American society, it others us. Muslims have been around for hundreds of years.
Texas's Republican Governor Greg Abbott announced Texas will be partnering with Turning Point USA to establish chapters of the right-wing youth organization launched by the late Charlie Kirk in every high school in Texas. Governor Abbott said, quote, let me be clear, any school that stands in the way of a Club America program in their school should be reported immediately to the Texas Education Agency, unquote. Turning Point USA's high school chapters are called Club America. The move follows similar efforts by state officials in Oklahoma and Florida to establish Turning Point USA chapters in high schools. Australia's officially banned children under the age of 16 from using social media apps in the country starting today. The apps banned include Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Snapchat, X, YouTube, Reddit, Twitch, and Kick. Platforms will need to deactivate accounts for users under 16 and stop them from making accounts or face fines up to $33 million. Amnesty International said in a statement, quote, many young people will no doubt find ways to avoid the restrictions. A ban simply means they will continue to be exposed to the same harms, but in secret, leaving them at even greater risk, they said. One student's dead and another was in critical condition after a shooting at Kentucky State University Tuesday. Officials say a suspect who's not a student at the school is in custody after the incident. According to the Gun Violence Archive, there have been 387 mass shootings in the United States so far this year. The Trump administration announced it's reached an agreement with several Republican-led states to end former President Biden's student loan repayment program. The program, called SAVE, which stands for Saving on a Valuable Education, is an income-driven repayment program which currently has more than 7 million borrowers. In a statement, the Education Department said it plans to stop all new enrollments under the plan, deny any pending applications, and transition borrowers into other repayment plans. Natalie Abrams, president of the Student Debt Crisis Center, said, quote, borrowers need real relief and stability, not a return to unaffordable, costly student loan payments that push them closer to financial crisis, unquote. A federal judge has ruled Tufts University PhD student Ramesa Öztürk can resume teaching and conducting research. In March, the Turkish-born student was abducted by masked immigration agents near Boston and the Tufts campus and then sent to an ICE jail in Louisiana where she was held for 6 weeks. She'd been targeted for co-writing a student article on Gaza in the student paper. Up until now, she had not been able to teach or do research because the Trump administration had revoked her visa. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker signed bills aimed to prevent federal immigration agents from making arrests near courthouses, hospitals, or colleges. Another new law will also make it easier for people to sue federal agents if their constitutional rights have been violated. Meanwhile, a coalition of civil and immigrant rights groups are calling for the immediate closure of an ICE jail at Fort Bliss in El Paso, Texas. The groups allege detained immigrants have been beaten and sexually abused while being denied adequate medical care and food. President Trump's former personal lawyer, Alina Habba, who was installed as U.S. attorney for New Jersey, has resigned after a panel of federal judges ruled she was serving in her position unlawfully. Attorney General Pam Bondi said Habba would remain at the Justice Department to serve as a senior advisor. In election news, voters in Miami, Florida, have elected a Democratic mayor for the first time in nearly 30 years. In a stunning upset, former County Commissioner Eileen Higgins received about 59% of the vote, defeating Republican Emilio Gonzalez, who'd been endorsed by Trump. Eileen Higgins will become Miami's first female mayor. In another setback for Republicans in Georgia, Democrat Eric Gissler flipped a state House seat in a district Trump won by double digits last year. And New York City Comptroller Brad Landers launching a primary challenge against Democratic Congressmember Dan Goldman. The congressional district covers the southern part of Manhattan and parts of Brooklyn. New York City Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani endorsed Lander, saying, quote, he's been a trusted ally and partner of mine. I'm proud to support him as I know he'll continue delivering for those who need government to show up for them the most, Mamdani said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Sudan, where fighting continues after the UAE-backed Rapid Support Forces attacked a preschool last year, a hospital, and other sites in the state of South Kordofan, killing at least 116 people, including 46 children. This happened last week. Reports from the WHO say parents and caregivers rushed the wounded to a nearby hospital even as the attack was ongoing. Paramedics and responders were also reportedly attacked. Since fighting between the RSF and the Sudanese military broke out in April 2023, an estimated 150,000 people have been killed and at least 12 million displaced. Aid groups say the true death toll is likely far higher. Hundreds of thousands also face famine. On Monday, the RSF seized the Heglig oil field, the country's largest. This follows other RSF advances, including the seizure of Al-Fashir, Darfur's largest city, in October. In this clip from Amnesty International, a survivor describes what happened when she fled Al-Fashir with her five children and was stopped by three armed men.
One of them forced me to go with them, cut my robe and raped me. When they left, my 14-year-old daughter came to me. I found that her clothes had blood on them and were cut into pieces. Her hair at the back of her head was full of dust. She came to me and said, "Mum, they raped me too. But do not tell anyone." After the rape, my daughter became really sick. When we reached Tooele, her health deteriorated, and she died at the clinic.
Also this week on Tuesday, the United States Treasury announced sanctions against four people and four entities accused of recruiting Colombian mercenaries to fight alongside the RSF in Sudan. To discuss all this and more, we're joined by two guests. Nathaniel Raymond is executive director of the Humanitarian Research Lab at the Yale School of Public Health. The lab's been monitoring al-Fashir. He's joining us from New Haven. And here in New York, we're joined by Khaled Khair, a Sudanese political analyst, head of the Confluence Advisory, a think tank founded in Khartoum. Welcome to Democracy Now! Khaled, let's begin with you. We just heard this horrific story, and this follows last week's attack on the kindergarten and a hospital. At least 46 children were killed. For people who are not following what is happening in Sudan, can you explain why these warring parties are still fighting after 2 years?
Sure. Well, this war started because the Sudanese Armed Forces, the National Army, and the Rapid Support Forces, a really powerful paramilitary group, fell out of favor with each other. They were once very much allied. They committed the genocide together in Darfur 20 years ago. They led a coup against a civilian cabinet more than two and a half years ago, in 2021. And then they fell out because there wasn't any kind of security arrangements that both were happy with. Now, this war is the world's largest at the moment. It's the world's largest hunger crisis, world's largest humanitarian crisis, world's largest displacement crisis, and as we heard in your reportage, the world's largest protection crisis because of the number of women and girls in particular who are being exposed to gender-based violence. And this war really, to a lot of people, seems like a nonsensical conflict because the level of fighting cannot possibly justify any political machinations of either of the two sides. But this war has now mushroomed into something much, much larger. Almost every part of Sudan is somehow impacted by this war. People who pushed against military rule in the revolution of 2018 and 2019 are by and large the parts of the society that are facing the most repression from both the Sudanese Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces. And so we're seeing really a war against civilians. While the SAF and the RSF are fighting each other, they're really fighting the people of Sudan. And that's why you get the nursery killings that we saw last week. You see barrel bombs being used by the Sudanese Armed Forces against largely civilian sites. You see the mass atrocity and genocide that's taking place in Darfur. And all of that really can be described, I think, best for people unfamiliar with the story, as a means for the security services in Sudan, both the Sudanese Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces, to really try and kill any kind of revolutionary zeal in Sudan and to make sure that they pave the way for their vision of military rule.
Can you talk about the role of the United Arab Emirates? What's their interest in backing the RSF? And then talk about how and why former Colombian military personnel came to fight alongside the RSF. We'll talk about the international dimensions of this.
Sure. Well, increasingly, as the war continues, we get to see more and more of these proxy elements. And the most obvious one has been the United Arab Emirates. It, of course, denies supporting the RSF. But the United States' own intelligence community, the United Nations panel of experts on Darfur have all shown that the UAE has been supporting the RSF pretty much from the outset of the war and probably before that. The UAE has been familiar with the RSF for some time. The RSF and the Sudanese Armed Forces were part of the Saudi-Emirati coalition on Yemen, and that's where their relationship really started. But the UAE now is interested in land in Sudan, arable land, fertile land for agriculture. It's interested in supply lines that go through the western part of Sudan and the southern part of Sudan that the RSF largely controls. It has some interest in Red Sea access. It is also interested in having some kind of influence over the Red Sea, which of course is a very large and very important commercial zone. And because of that, it has given the RSF huge volumes of weapons and very sophisticated weapons from as far away as China. But there are also allegations that German, Swedish, British, American, and Canadian weaponry that has been sold to the United Arab Emirates has found its way in the RSF's hands in places like Darfur. Now, what we've seen recently is an uptick of mercenary action that is reported to have come through the Global Security Services Group, a UAE-based company that gets particularly Colombian mercenaries that have been phased out of the Colombian soldiers who have been phased out of the Colombian military since the 2016 peace agreement in Colombia, and those people have effectively found new livelihood sources through this UAE-based company, and most of them have now found themselves in Darfur. Now, there are some reports that these mercenaries will continue to be part of the coalition in Sudan, as we have seen them in Yemen and as we have seen them in Libya. So this is part of a broader UAE security infrastructure that's been put in place that we're now seeing brought to bear in Sudan.
And the U.S. Treasury announcing sanctions against four people and four companies accused of aiding the RSF by enlisting Colombian mercenaries. Can you talk about the role of the U.S., which is increasingly aligned with Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, UAE being the backer of one of the sides of the RSF, what power they have here?
So the U.S. has a lot of power. The question is, will they use it? Because Sudan is, even though it is the world's largest conflict by scale right now, it is not very important, has not been a priority country for the United States, which means that increasingly what we're seeing is that the U.S. allies are able to, you know, be involved in the war in Sudan, whether they're by supporting one of the armed actors or, in the case of Egypt and Turkey, by increasing its weapons support to, for example, the Sudanese armed forces, and really allowing for these proxy elements to take part in order to keep their allies in the region happy. And, you know, the biggest country that's sort of the biggest priority, I should say, in the region for the United States is, of course, Israel. And here we see that Arab countries, particularly the United Arab Emirates, that, of course, is very close to Israel, is an ally of Israel in the region, probably one of the few, has really been able to use that relationship, to leverage that relationship against Washington in terms of what it can get away with as far as the United States is concerned. And this is what puts Sudan, unfortunately, in a very difficult position, and the rights and sort of the, you know, potential ability for civilians in Sudan to get access, to get an end to the fighting, to get a peace deal or some kind of ceasefire. All of that is complicated by the regional picture and, in particular, the interests of American allies.
The United Nations is saying more resources are needed to adequately address the humanitarian crisis. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, says the Sudan response plan is only one-third funded, due largely to Western donor cuts.
What is very real is that people are fleeing this advance of the RSF. I was in a place called Adaba. This is in the so-called northern state, north of Khartoum, where there is a smaller camp. You know, the biggest camp is Tawila, taking people from El Fasher. This is a smaller camp, taking people also from El Fasher, but also from Kordofan and other places. And their stories are, unfortunately, all the same. Rape, murder, forced recruitment of children, separation of families, and sheer robbery. We are barely responding. I have to say, in the site, I only visited this particular site, which is not very big, about 11, 12,000 people, but arrivals all the time. We saw people just arrive, literally.
So that's the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi. We're bringing in now Nathaniel Raymond, Executive Director of the Humanitarian Research Lab at the Yale School of Public Health, which is monitoring El Fasher. Nathaniel, we last had you on weeks ago. Explain the latest findings of your lab. You said El Fasher is beginning to look a lot like a slaughterhouse. We haven't spoken to you since, for example, the kindergarten was attacked last week with over 40 children killed.
What we're seeing through very high-resolution satellite imagery is at least 140 large piles of bodies that appear at the end of October into early November. And we see basically a pattern of activity by the rapid support forces that indicates they've been burning and burying bodies for almost the better part of 5 weeks. Meanwhile, we see none of the pattern of life that we expect to see in a place with civilians. There's grass growing in the main market in El Fasher. There's no activity at the water points or in the streets. And there's no sign of civilian vehicles such as donkey carts or cars. We see a ghost town where the only visible activity is rapid support forces and what's called their technicals, their armed pickup trucks, moving objects consistent with human remains around, burying them and burning them.
Moving from what's happening now, the horror we're hearing described, to the International Criminal Court in The Hague, they've just sentenced the former Janjaweed leader, Ali Mohammed Ali Abdelrahman, known as Ali Kushaib, to 20 years in prison for atrocities committed in the Darfur region like 20 years ago, in 2003 and 4. He faced 31 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity, turned himself in, transferred to ICC custody in 2020. The RSF is largely seen as successors to the Janjaweed. This is the presiding ICC judge, Joanna Corner.
Abd al-Rahman's conviction is the first acknowledgement that the people of Darfur were not victims of mere intertribal conflict or something akin to that. They were victims of a deliberate campaign. The chamber made it very clear, orchestrated by those in power, executed by the Janjaweed, led by Mr. Abd al-Rahman in the Wadi Saleh region. Under the authority of the government of Sudan, even if not specifically ordered by anyone in particular.
So that was the presiding judge of the International Criminal Court sentencing the Janjaweed leader. This is crimes committed over 20 years ago. You grew up in Sudan, Khalid Khair. Is it proper to think of, as we wrap up this segment, the RSF as the kind of successors of the Janjaweed and the significance of this sentencing?
Absolutely. I mean, I think first and foremost that a lot of people will feel that 20 years is far too little for what Ali Kushaib has committed. And others will feel that it's not enough, of course. There are four other indictees, including the former president, President Omar al-Bashir, and another very key indictee called Ahmed Haroon, who, according to the ICC, was working very closely with Ali Kushaib. Now, the issue is that both Omar al-Bashir and Ahmed Haroon are currently in Sudan, and reports say that they're being protected by the Sudanese armed forces. And this just shows you the extent to which neither the RSF nor the SAF want to see justice done in Sudan for previous crimes or indeed for current crimes, and have blocked every single justice mechanism that we have seen. That said, Darfuri people and communities that I speak to say that at least now we're seeing some kind of justice, some kind of recompense at the global stage, because we're not going to get it at the national stage. No government in Sudan has ever been interested in bringing about justice for particularly those from places like Darfur and the Kordofans. So some measure of justice, but by no means enough.
You left just a year or two ago from Sudan. You travel the world. You talk about the situation in Sudan. What do you think, as we wrap up, are the biggest misconceptions, and what's the most important action that must be taken now?
I think people get very much invested in the military elements of this war. Who has gained what ground, you know, which armed actor is potentially on the road to winning it or isn't. What we have seen in Sudan's history is that no military actor has ever won a war outright, whether that's the Central Sudanese Armed Forces or any group that they have fought, no matter how strong they are. And so investing in a military victory, investing in this narrative that we will get some kind of victor, is probably not going to serve us. I think we need to focus on the victims. And as you said, the UN envelope for humanitarian aid is very, you know, poorly resourced. I think about 16% funded. And those are the people we need to focus on. There are emergency response rooms and mutual aid groups. These are volunteer-led groups of civil society actors that are at the brunt, at the forefront of the humanitarian relief. And nobody's really looking at them, I think, sufficiently. Nobody's helping them. No one is putting money and resources to them to enable them to save lives. And they have won a string of awards. They have been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize twice. But we have not seen that translate to political support, and we haven't seen that translate sufficiently to financial support. I think investing in those groups, both for the humanitarian response and for, you know, frankly, allowing them to weave back the social fabric that this war has ripped apart, I think that is a much better investment of time than focusing on the belligerent parties.
I want to thank you, Khalid Khair, for being with us, Sudanese political analyst, head of the Confluence Advisory. It's great to have you in our studio. And Nathaniel Raymond, executive director of Humanitarian Research Lab at the Yale School of Public Health, monitoring al-Fashir. We'll link to your reports at democracynow.org. Coming up, torture and enforced disappearances at ICE jails in Florida, from the Everglades to Chrome. And then we will look at the case of the mother of the nephew of the White House press spokesperson. She was just released from an ICE jail yesterday. Stay with us.